There was an unusual casualty of war recently, not the war in Iraq, but the American Civil War. Sam White, a Civil War memorabilia collector, found an artillery shell and took it to his home in Chester, Virginia, just south of Richmond. It detonated in his driveway, killing him and sending shrapnel as much as a quarter mile away. The accident is a tragic reminder that military ordnance can remain deadly long after war's end. Jimmy Blankenship is the historian and curator at the Petersburg National Battlefield in Virginia. He joins us from there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Have you ever heard of anybody else being killed by old Civil War era ordnance in the way that Mr. White was killed?
There have been some people injured by trying to disarm some Civil War artillery shells, but I think you got to go back to the 1960s to find someone actually being killed by one of them.
How long can a shell like this, a piece of ordnance like this, last?
It's been over 140 years since the war ended, and there are a good number of these items around. We did find a shell at Petersburg National Battlefield about a month ago, and we called the Virginia State Police Bomb Squad, and they split it open, and the powder inside was still dry. If a spark or a flame could have gotten into that shell, it probably would have exploded. So the powder can remain dry for many, many years. The bigger the shell, the thicker the iron is, and so it's just going to take that much longer for the iron to eventually rust away. But it's going to take probably a couple of hundred years at least for that to happen. And in most cases, the powder usually is still dry. So the idea is to try to get the powder out of these shells. Now, just pouring water into it and letting it sit is not going to work, because once the powder dries back out, it is still dangerous.
So how do these shells detonate? Can they detonate by contact, or is there a fuse that you light?
Everybody and their grandmother was inventing weapons during the Civil War, so there's many different varieties of how you set them off.
You're the historian and curator of the Petersburg National Battlefield. Do you have a lot of this old Civil War ordnance, or has most of it been picked up?
I believe that relic hunters back in the 1960s and 70s pretty much got most of the shells out of the park. There are probably still some out there, but not in large numbers.
So what's your advice to people who might come across some of this ordnance and want to pick it up and keep it as a collector?
Number one, do not try to disarm it. You can buy these things on the Internet already diffused. Get one from a reputable dealer. That would be the safest thing. It's easier to spend a couple of hundred dollars and buy one than to take a chance on one blowing up on you.
Jimmy Blankenship is the historian and curator at the Petersburg National Battlefield in Virginia. Thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
This is NPR News. If you're driving the Atlantic Seaboard later this month, you may catch a curious sight. A bright green double-decker bus headed toward Baltimore. It will be traveling very, very slowly. Don't get annoyed and start honking, because on board is a tiny troupe of circus performers returning to Europe after a world tour that has lasted more than a decade. NPR's John Burnett met up with the Sprocket Circus in Texas.
Two circus performers are entertaining a crowd on the tree-shaded deck outside of Central Market in Austin on a recent Sunday afternoon. The show is good, but not terribly unusual. There's juggling, a unicycle, acrobatics, and lots of slapstick humor. What's remarkable about the Sprocket Circus is their itinerary. On the road nonstop since 1997, they've performed for audiences in 33 countries, from street kids in Calcutta to the Sultan of Brunei, and in hundreds of villages from Turkey to Thailand to Guatemala. They ship their bus between continents on container ships, which, at $5,000 per trip, keeps them a subsistence circus.
I'm Isabel Ferro. I'm French, and I've been doing circus show for 16 years.
And my name is Scott Harrison. I'm from Bath in England, and I started doing circus when I met Izzy 16 years ago.
They travel with their now 11-year-old son, Teo, who was away playing with new friends during this interview. The fourth member of the troupe is a lime green 1962 Bristol double-decker bus.
There we go, 45 years. Beautiful.
How is it that your bus only goes 33 miles an hour top speed?
It was designed as a city bus. It was designed to just pick people up and drop people off around a city. So there was no need for it to go any faster than 33 miles an hour. And at the time, in 1962, when this bus was made, 33 miles an hour was quite a respectable speed.
As the old double-decker has chugged along highways in Iran, Nepal, Singapore, Colombia, and California, it has taught the circus family things about the people who inhabit these places. It has taught them about the notion of civilization.
You know, you don't see a bus like this every day, and you still, people will get you the finger because you're too slow, or shout at you, swear at you, you know.
Yeah. When you're driving your bus in a third world country, you
don't
get the finger, and they don't shout at you?
No, they wave, and they're just so happy, and, you know, it's just so different. And then you feel, hey, this is what you call a civilized country, because civil mean polite.
In this respect, of all the places they've traveled all over the world, their least favorite was right here in the USA, the Golden State.
Well, we had a lot of finger in California. We had a lot of people shouting.
Yeah, it wasn't a good place. We didn't enjoy California, and I don't think they enjoyed us.
They're speaking from inside the bus, crammed with trapeze rigging, costumes, golf clubs, Teo's school books and Lego, and a wood-burning stove. The Sprockets have lived in this bus on the road for so long, they've noticed how the digital revolution has changed the world, selectively. Cell phones and text messaging is everywhere, but some cultures seem to have surrendered to it more than others. Izzy and Scott have watched how some places, particularly in Latin America, still prize human interaction over wireless communication.
And then when you get back to the West with all our high-tech stuff, you see how people have lost all their communication skills. You know, the really important skills, not emailing people, but just being able to sit and meet a piazza and exchange conversation, just sit there and have a drink together. It's not happening enough.
This adventure is about to be over. They're still looking for a few more gigs on the East Coast in the next few weeks. But when their U.S. visas expire next month and their bus is in the hold of a ship steaming towards Southampton, England, they hope to find a real home in Europe. Izzy says she's ready.
The circus is my passion, and that I will not stop. But now I wouldn't mind having a base, somewhere where every day I can stop. I wouldn't mind having a garden, something that I can plant my flowers, you know. I wouldn't mind having a cat or a dog, you know. And that's the kind of thing that I miss.
How long they stay put is anybody's guess. Scott Harrison's next project is to acquire a boat that will accommodate the bus, then take their tiny circus to small islands inaccessible by commercial freighter. The Sprockets' second world tour. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
The Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction has, in recent years, gone to some writers you might be familiar with, for example, Philip Roth, E.L. Doctorow, John Updike. But tonight, in Washington, D.C., the prize will be accepted by a relative unknown, Kate Christensen. Her darkly comic novels about society's outsiders have delighted her fans, but have never received widespread acclaim until now. NPR's Robert Smith reports on what happens when a woman who writes about failure suddenly wins big.
When I go over to Kate Christensen's row house in the Greenpoint neighborhood of Brooklyn, I'm not terribly surprised when I find she's cooking this big green pot of soup.
Let's see what this is doing.
In her novels, the characters are always whipping something up to eat.
This is named after Saint-Germain, which is a suburb of Paris. Apparently they grew peas in their garden, so the name of it is lovely. Potage Saint-Germain.
It's the sort of simple meal with the pretentious name that would have been featured in her most recent novel, The Great Man. The book is the story of a dead painter and the remarkable trio of women he left behind. His wife, his mistress, his sister. They're all women in their 70s, all frustrated in some way. And they use food like a weapon to intimidate their rivals or seduce their lovers.
Writing the food was like writing dialogue, a way of revealing more of who they were. And then I made all the recipes, and they all turned out really well, I have to say.
Christensen is in her mid-40s. That she would even write a story of love and sex and revenge among 70-year-old women is quite an achievement.
I don't know that many books where the older women get to be the protagonists of the novel and get to have sex and get to be sexual and get to have opinions and say bad words and, you know, really just sort of strut around on the stage. And that's part of what made me want to write it.
Christensen delights in giving characters who live on the fringe their moment in the spotlight. In her first novel, In the Drink, her heroine was a 20-something underemployed drunk. The subject matter got Christensen labeled as just another chick-lit writer. So she started writing about male losers for a change. Her next novel was about a celebrity hanger-on who gets booted out of his cushy life. Her third book featured a misanthropic poet slowly trying to kill himself.
I'm really interested in people who are a little bit crabby and a little bit unfulfilled and have a lot to yearn for.
So you can imagine Christensen's reaction when the Penn Faulkner Foundation called to tell her she was a winner of a prize she didn't even know she was up for.
The Penn Faulkner, I mean, it's not the kind of award I even dreamed of winning. I didn't really think I was that kind of writer. Philip Roth and John Updike and Tobias Wolff, you notice they're all men.
Only four other women have won the award. And Christensen says she doesn't want to launch a feminist critique of the prize, but...
It's hard not to notice that men win more awards than women and are taken more seriously. But I also think women write more character-driven, on the whole, to generalize wildly, more character-driven fiction, and it's not taken as seriously as the show-off-y sort of stylistic tour de forces that men seem to write more of.
The judges of the Penn Faulkner Awards say that, at least this year, they chose the novel that simply delighted them the most. Molly Giles was on the judging panel and says she just couldn't get the characters that Christensen created out of her head.
This was a pleasure to read about. Sophisticated, intelligent, honest, vain, sexual, older women. And I really liked the way that, as far as I can see, Kate Christensen is a young woman, the way she evoked these characters.
The prospect of being an award-winning author does create a little bit of stress for Christensen. She says she's lived much of her life watching from the sidelines. When she was a child, she created this make-believe world that she could control. She wanted to be invisible so she could stare at other people. Now, when she accepts her prize tonight, everyone will be gawking at her.
It makes you vulnerable also to win an award. It's not just a pure thing. Before I won the award, nobody had ever heard of me, really. And so I felt like I was operating in a kind of safe anonymity. And writing these books about failed artists or somebody who doesn't have what they want. And those are the kind of people that appeal to me.
And not only did you get what you want, you got what you didn't even know you wanted.
I didn't even know I wanted it. I didn't even dream of it.
The book that won the Penn Faulkner Award, The Great Man, will be released in paperback next week. And luckily, Christensen says she's already finished her next book. It's called Trouble, and is about two successful and famous women who, no surprise here, have lives that are falling apart. In Christensen's world, even winners can be losers. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles are touring, performing songs from their new album, and critics, well, at least one, are proclaiming soul, fire, warmth, and we'll add energy, passion, and fun. Langhorne Slim joins us from Nashville with band members Paul DeFiglia on the stand-up bass and Malachi DiLorenzo on drums. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
So that was a song called The Rebel Side of Heaven from your new album called Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles. What's The Rebel Side of Heaven?
Well, I was spending some time with a friend a few years ago, and she had a very dear friend who wasn't doing so well in his life. And he was drinking quite a bit, and we were hanging out with him one night, and he said, "Guys, you know, things are just going terribly, and you know, I think I'm just going to, when I go, I'm going to hell." And this girl turned to him and said, "You're not going to hell. You're going to the rebel side of heaven."
Great thought. So what happened to him?
He died and went straight to hell. No, I thought that this friend and I were going to be spending more time with each other. But as it turned out, she and I, you know, stopped spending time. And as a result, her friend and I, we didn't keep up with each other.
So you didn't get a friend out of it, but you got a song out of it. So that's fair trade-off, I guess.
I think so, yeah.
Your parents named you Sean Skolnick. How'd you become Langhorne Slim?
Langhorne is a town in Pennsylvania that I'm from, and I was patiently waiting for somebody to give me a nickname that I thought, you know, suited me. To be honest with you, the truth of it is that when I was young, I really wanted to be a black blues singer, and it's taken me up to 27 to realize that that's not gonna happen for me. And I just thought it sounded cool and sort of fit in the tradition of a lot of the music that I was listening to at the time.
And why did you want to be a black blues singer?
I think deep down we all probably do, but I could be wrong about that. It's music that I fell very deeply in love with. I just thought it was, you know, some of the most raw, passionate, heartfelt music.
So you guys have your instruments with you in Nashville there, right?
We do indeed.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you play us your song about how we love the animals?
You got it.
Three.
And all the children are saying, what good friends we have. We love the animals. The fish are in the ocean, the birds are in the sky. We're singing and we're dancing, oh, ain't it great to be alive with all the good friends we have. We love the animals. Life is crazy, it's a zoo, and we love the animals. The monkeys are happy, the zebras are playing, giraffes are laughing, and all the children are saying, what good friends we have. We love the animals. The fish are in the ocean, the birds are in the sky, we're singing and we're dancing, oh, ain't it great to be alive with all the good friends. We love the animals. We love the animals. We love the animals. We love the animals. We love the animals.
We love the animals, performed by Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles. You also have animals on the cover art of the album. What's that all about? It's kind of a leopard pattern, right?
To my mother's dismay, the cover art is taken from pillows and chairs that her and my father picked out when they bought their house sometime in the 70s. So my mother has seen that a whole lot, and I have a feeling actually my father might have picked it out, and so she's not so thrilled that it's on the cover. But
so it's the actual pattern?
Yeah, it's just a photograph of the pillow.
I would think you guys sort of thought you had it made when you were picked up by V2 Records, which also had the White Stripes and the Dave Matthews Band, but then the label closed. What happened, and what kind of effect does that have on your morale and your career?
I think what you learn is you got to have, belief in what you're doing, and so none of that sort of stuff. The ups don't get you too up, the downs don't get you too down, and you just continue to do what you're doing because you love to do it.
You know, I just wonder about whether the music business right now is, it just seems like it's in such flux that you just never know whether your record label is going to be around, but you can self-record and sell your stuff on the internet.
And what is a constant and what will never go away and what you can know is that there's always going to be people out there that want to come to shows. And that's something that, you know, the record business isn't going to affect one way or the other, I don't think. So for us, you know, we take some comfort in knowing that, you know, we keep plugging away on the road and building more and more people coming out. And the other stuff will take care of itself, I hope.
How about another song?
You got it. The song's called Diamonds and Gold.
You can have all the diamonds, you can have all the gold. Someday you're still gonna get old. You've gotta learn to get happy along the way. Take some chances, allow yourself to get lost. You're beautiful, baby, you're the boss. You've got to learn to get happy along the way. There's no foe to follow. all the diamonds, all the gold. Someday we're all gonna wind up very, 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 very old. It's time we get happy along the way. Get your hat, get your coat, baby. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Take my hand, let's get happy along the way.
That's Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles with a song called Diamonds and Gold. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listen to Langhorne Slim perform his new songs and discover more new music at npr.org/music. This is Weekend Edition. Dr. Simon returns next week. I'm John Idstein. The world of patents seems poised on the brink of chaos. A 1999 law that changed how U.S. patent law judges are appointed may have started a chain of events that could invalidate thousands of patent decisions, decisions worth billions of dollars. For the past 8 years, 46 judges who oversee the patent process have been chosen by the director of the Patent and Trademark Office, and that is almost surely unconstitutional. The person who discovered the problem is John Duffy, a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. He joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So why do you believe that the appointment of these judges is unconstitutional?
The Constitution of the United States has a clause called the Appointments Clause. It specifies four and only four ways in which officers of the United States can be appointed. The president, with the advice and consent of the Senate, can appoint officers. That's the normal method. It's used for cabinet officials, for Supreme Court justices and other officials. The other three methods are the president alone, appointment by a court of law. The Patent and Trademark Office is an agency, not a court. And finally, by a head of department. And someone like the Secretary of Commerce qualifies. Someone who is an undersecretary quite surely does not qualify. Mm-hmm. And the head of the Patent Office is the undersecretary for intellectual property.
So how does this affect the validity of the decisions made by these 46 judges appointed since 1999?
Well, the judges sit in panels of three judges, and even if only one of the judges is invalidly appointed, the panel itself lacks authority. So you can do a sort of quick calculation and figure out what percentage of panels are likely to have at least one of these judges, given that about two-thirds are unconstitutionally appointed. And the answer is well into the 90% of panels.
Could this cause a big disruption? For instance, people who have licensed a patent to manufacture a drug might pause as a result of the uncertainty and cause drug shortages or something like that.
I think that companies who have purchased licenses or purchased patents are going to find this event unsettling, particularly if their patent remains in the adjudicatory process or is subject to reconsideration or reexamination under this board. In that sense, it's going to cause a great deal of legal disruption. I don't think that it is likely that drugs won't be on the market because of the legal uncertainty. law firms and corporations have a great ability to contract around legal uncertainty so that the underlying market can still go forward and be profitable and make and generate revenue and make money. Who will get those profits might change depending upon the outcome of this controversy.
How did you stumble across this? I mean, you didn't go looking for it, I don't imagine. What was it that happened that made you say, wait a minute, this can't be right?
Well, one of the great things about being a professor is that you have academic freedom. You can find things that seem interesting and sort of spark your curiosity. At the time, last summer, there was a suit about various structural components of the patent office. It dealt with other issues, but I was curious of that issue, of that lawsuit. I thought it was actually sort of a great case. It was almost like an administrative law exam. And when I was looking at that case, I looked carefully at the statutes that constitute the agency. And as soon as I read it, I said, that can't be right. I teach in this area of law. I teach the law of the way that agencies, administrative agencies, can be constitutionally constructed. And I know for sure that this is not one of them.
John Duffy teaches patent and administrative law at George Washington University Law School. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Before Scott Simon left town to accept his honorary degree at Lake Forest College, he dropped off this installment of NPR's In Character series, Good Old Charlie Brown.
Charlie Brown is the kid who always misses the football because Lucy snatches it away just before he can kick it. The kid who's left out on the pitcher's mound in the rain. The kid whose kite gets snarled in a tree. The kid who leaps into a pile of leaves and hits a rock. He has a hopeless crush.
Dear little red-haired girl, how I've longed to meet you. Oh!
Which, like some embarrassing bruise, he mistakenly reveals to his friends. Judith Viorst, who writes books for adults and children and studies psychoanalysis, says of Charlie Brown,
I like him enormously, and I think the whole world likes him.
Good grief, Charlie Brown, you're ridiculous! Boy, were you dumb in school today. It's your own fault, because you're so wishy-washy.
You're hopeless, Charlie Brown, completely hopeless.
Just nobody in his comic strip likes him.
Charlie Brown, whom his own dog calls that round-headed kid, came into the world in October of 1950, drawn by Charles Schulz, who named him after one of his art instructors in Minneapolis. By the time Charles Schulz died in 2000, Charlie Brown and his friends in the comic strip Peanuts appeared in almost 3,000 newspapers in 75 different countries. They starred in top-rated television specials, books, and a musical. Their images may have appeared on more things, T-shirts, greeting cards, party wear, calendars, and balloons in the last half of the 20th century than Mao Zedong's. Lynn Johnston, who draws the strip for better or for worse, says of Charlie's image,
it's like an emblem or a... As memorable as the Coke sign or the Nike swipe or anything else, you see that Charlie Brown, and that just says it all. It really does. That expression, that simple line, and just that wonderful look.
The Apollo 10 astronauts even named their command module Charlie Brown and the lunar rover Snoopy. It may be telling that Charlie got to orbit the moon, but Snoopy landed there while Charlie just circled in darkness.
Oh, good grief.
Anthony Rapp, who played Charlie in the 1999 revival of the musical You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, observes,
you think of him as sort of a sad sack, but he's also incredibly resilient. And that's the thing that I discovered in playing him.
I like you, Charlie Brown. Sign, little red-haired girl. Boy! Just wait till September, boy. Just wait.
I moved around a lot as a child, saying goodbye to old friends, trying to fit in with new ones. But Charlie Brown and his friends could always be found along the wall, on the ball field, or in front of Snoopy's doghouse. He seemed to be the soul of can-do Kennedy-era optimism, but nagged by anxieties that would bring him to Lucy's backyard therapy stand. Did his dog really like him, or just the food he brought? Would the stars stay up in the sky? And what made him just a little different?
Maybe you have pantophobia. Do you think you have pantophobia?
What's pantophobia?
The fear of everything. That's it!
Lynn Johnston became a friend of Charles Schulz's, but she grew up knowing Charlie Brown in Northern Ontario.
When you're young, you have incredibly strong emotions and really profound thoughts, but you just don't have the vocabulary or the experience to know how to voice those opinions. And so when somebody in such a wonderful medium as a comic strip could give us a voice, that was impressive.
Over the years, Charles Schulz occasionally estimated that Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, and Schroeder all seemed to be suspended at about 8 years of age. Judith Viorst reminds us that's an unkind age for children.
They seem to have these cruel measures of success, which poor Charlie is not very good at. I think they would admire him if his team ever won a ball game, if he ever succeeded in flying a kite. I think basically he is perceived by these otherwise decent kids, but pretty harsh in their judgment of him, as he's perceived as a loser, as a failure in the world of kiddom.
So we asked three residents of Kiddom, Ian Green, Andrew Simmons, and Maribel Allen, all from Los Angeles and all 11 years of age, to talk about the Charlie Brown that they've grown up with. Mr. Green goes first.
He's cool in his own way. He's not one of those kids that thinks, oh, you know what, I'm going to wear these awesome sunglasses, my awesome gangster leather jacket, you know? I'm so cool. He's his own person. He's his own character in his own mind, and he's very creative.
He's in his own box. If you could picture that.
You know, I think political consultants would call that authenticity.
Charlie Brown does things different.
Yet it's an old childhood story. The nicer Charlie Brown is, the more it seems to irritate people, who mock him as wishy-washy. When Anthony Rapp played Charlie Brown on Broadway, he got to sing along with what amounts to Charlie's credo.
Happiness is two kinds of ice cream.
Knowing a secret.
Climbing a tree.
Happiness is five different crayons.
Catching a firefly, setting him free.
A lot of critics found the song a little wishy-washy. 10 years later, Mr. Rapp still ruminates about the boy he played.
I don't know that he'll ever really be able to fully find happiness because, well, it would be interesting to see as he grows up whether he'd be able to continue to weather those storms over and over and over again, or if they would in fact make all of the sort of hope leak out of him.
This time I'm gonna kick that football clear to the moon!
But what use is hope if there's never any reward? For 50 years, Lucy held out the football for Charlie Brown. For 50 years, he ran at it, only to have her snatch it away and make him fall on his back. In a world that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, what do you say after being fooled for 50 years? Is Charlie Brown a good man who trusts others, or a fool who deceives himself? Lynn Johnston says she didn't find Charlie's unflagging faith in Lucy to be endearing.
I always kind of thought that he should probably tell her off.
But Judith Viorst and Anthony Rapp think that would be a false note for Charlie Brown.
You're asking him to be a far more cynical person than he will ever be in his life. I mean, he is your absolute model of hope springs eternal. Lucy always assures him that it's going to be different this year, and he figures, why not believe her?
And now you could argue that that's just foolishness, but I argue that it's actually optimism. And a certain kind of optimism, like continuing to give somebody the benefit of the doubt, believing in the better nature of people.
We asked our panel of childhood experts on Charlie Brown. Is there something that you'd like to tell him? I mean, if you could reach into that cartoon panel.
I would say, you ought to know that you're in a comic book for the past 50 years. And I would ought to say, don't listen to other people. Be yourself.
I would say, don't always be so angry at yourself. You know, if you do one thing wrong, doesn't mean that you have to get all mad and say, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that?
Charlie Brown can't leap tall buildings in a single bound. He can't even get his kite out of a tree. He isn't a cartoon character who bristles with superpowers. But he may be something more extraordinary among children, not to mention adults, as we all grow up and struggle to get noticed, be pretty, funny, or popular, and win candy, stars, ribbons, grades, friends, lovers, money, or toys. Ian Green says,
Charlie Brown is like, you know, oh, Captain America, he saved the people from the burning building. Charlie Brown became this famous and this special from just being himself. He doesn't have to be a superhero. That's what makes him a famous comic book character.
Despite all temptation and frustration, his bruised heart and backside, Charlie Brown is nice. And do we tell ourselves often enough? Do we tell our children how important that really is?
For happiness is anyone and anything at all that's loved by you.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
Scott Simon, NPR News. This is Weekend Edition, directed by Elaine Heintzman, and produced by Darcy Bacon, Justine Kennan, Bridget McCarthy, Janaea Williams, MJ Davis, Elliot Hannon, Zoe Chase, and Sarah Beyer-Kelly. Our technical director is Burke Hun, so ably assisted by Lamar Nickens, Marty Kersius, and Handy Andy Rosenberg. Librarians are Key Molesky, Mary Glenn Denning, and Robert Goldstein. The senior editor is Tony Marcano, and the senior producer of Weekend Edition Saturday is Peter Breslow. Dr. Simon returns next week. I'm John Itstein.